Hi, Marco Werman here. Before we get to the show, time is running out to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. If you've already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year, thank you. You make it possible for us to do this very important work, to bring human-centered coverage from all around the globe to your ears every single weekday, to bring you stories straight from lived experience from the people who are impacted the most, and to broaden your horizons and keep you connected to the world beyond our borders. If you have not given yet, this is your chance. By making a gift, you're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Now, the show. As Omicron rips across the globe, governments rush to respond. In the UK, that could mean a political cost for Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
I'm beginning to wonder whether he is, in fact, now past his sell-by date.
And maybe junked by his party. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, how an Afghan advocate for women and girls plans to keep the doors open at her shelter in Kabul.
In the year ahead, I'm just going to hold on. I'm going to beg the world to help.
And in California, Latino farm workers are marking Las Posadas, a Christmas celebration reenacting the nativity scene. Last year, no parties. This year, it's on.
People, you know, they have faith and they are longing because for some time they missed this in-person coming and participation.
Today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. Just 3 days now until the Christmas holiday and family gatherings. Looming over all of it, the threat of Omicron, the highly contagious strain of the coronavirus. The hope is that get-togethers can happen without spoiling New Year's festivities 1 week later, but a week is also a long time when it comes to COVID. We begin today by looking at some of the latest global responses to Omicron. The World's Carol Hills is with me. Hey, Carol.
Hey, Marco.
There seems to be some at least initially hopeful news about Omicron out of South Africa. What are you hearing?
Well, the news is that the latest data they've gathered about COVID cases shows that the number of cases are dropping. So that could mean that they're over the Omicron peak. And so what that could indicate is that infections from Omicron don't last as long. But they don't know that for sure, and there's just not enough information about how Omicron is affecting people worldwide. And so today at the World Health Organization's press conference, infectious disease epidemiologist Maria van Kerkhove was careful to make that point.
What we are learning about Omicron is certainly we have this increased transmission, but the information on severity is still uncertain. We don't have that complete picture yet, and it is too early to conclude whether or not Omicron is less severe than Delta or is as severe as Delta.
So meantime, many places around the globe are seeing a spike in cases from Omicron. Other places are preparing for the spike. Just yesterday, President Biden made his big announcement about making free home COVID tests available and steered way clear of any kind of shutdowns. But if you look just to our northern Canada, some provinces are taking stronger measures, right?
They are, and those measures have prompted Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to announce today, in fact, that he's extending financial support to businesses, his own pandemic plan. It was to end, and now he's extending it to late February because his most populous provinces haven't announced these restrictions. And they include things like, you know, British Columbia shutting down gyms and bars and nightclubs, you know, allowing fewer people at tables and restaurants, banning all indoor social events and gatherings. Montreal, Canada's second largest city, has declared a state of emergency to combat the virus. Quebec in general is taking a lot of steps. Here's Quebec's Minister of Health, Chris Dubé, yesterday.
I must tell you that this situation is critical. With the increase of cases and hospitalization, we must put in place new measures.
Like British Columbia, Quebec is shutting down bars, gyms, and casinos. They've ordered people to work from home to try to reduce the spread of Omicron. They've also closed schools. They're keeping them open only to provide a place to get vaccine.
That's extraordinary. And Canada is not the only country that's tightening things up. What about parts of Europe, Carol, instituting various forms of lockdowns?
The Netherlands has closed non-essential shops, bars, restaurants, gyms, schools. Sweden said this week it was adding new restrictions on gatherings. Finland is telling restaurants to close early on Friday. You know, in Portugal, nightclubs and bars are closing on Friday for at least 2 weeks. France hasn't added any new rules, but they still require proof of vaccination for entry into bars and restaurants. And in Britain is a whole separate story, which we're going to hear in a minute from our own Orla Berry.
One final thing, Carol. In the U.S., people who want a booster are struggling to find appointments. Just south of Europe, though, in Israel, they're recommending a fourth jab for some people. What's that about?
Well, it's the first country in the entire world to recommend a fourth jab. But you might remember, Marco, Israel was also the first country to recommend a third jab. And everyone gasped and thought, isn't that excessive? And then, you know, a number of months later, that's what the U.S. has been recommending. But I have to add that epidemiologists around the world are concerned because so many countries are waiting for their first jab.
Right. The world's Carol Hills. Thank you very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
Now we go to the United Kingdom, as Carol just flagged. It's been another terrible week there for Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister. There's a huge Omicron spike in the UK. New revelations of parties at 10 Downing Street when the country was under tight COVID restrictions. And Johnson's Conservative Party had a disastrous result in a recent special election. How much political trouble is Johnson in? The world's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has that.
Coming out to bat for Boris Johnson on British media this week is no small challenge. Take Dominic Raab, the Deputy Prime Minister. On Monday, he found himself struggling to explain why Johnson, his wife Carrie, and about 17 other colleagues were sitting around drinking wine in the gardens of 10 Downing Street when all the rest of the UK was under a strict lockdown.
Number 10 Downing Street and the garden is used for work. So it's fundamentally a place of work. They're all in suits. Look, the Prime Minister is in a suit. The officials there. So some of them have taken their jackets off.
Jackets on or off, the gathering appears to be yet another example of Johnson telling the public to do one thing and the Prime Minister doing the opposite. All the reports of alcohol-fuelled get-togethers by the government during lockdown are having an effect. A recent special election in North Shropshire in central England put Johnson's Conservative Party to the test.
A constituency that has elected a Conservative MP since the Great Reform Act of 1832 has rejected the party.
The Conservatives lost a parliamentary seat they had held for almost 200 years. And UK media is asking if Johnson is to blame.
This is the first week I can remember Tory MPs questioning whether Boris Johnson is still an election winner.
Some of Mr Johnson's MPs may look at this result and ask if their leader is becoming a liability.
How much more bad news can Boris Johnson survive?
Some of the Prime Minister's own party colleagues are wondering the same thing.
Mr Johnson has to prove that he's capable of being a good Prime Minister, and at the moment it's quite clear that the public don't think that that's the case.
That's Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale talking to the BBC a few days ago. Boris Johnson's big selling point has always been the way he can charm the British public. Matthew Flinders, Professor of Politics at the University of Sheffield, says Johnson isn't actually all that popular among fellow MPs.
He was carried into office more on the X factor that he could link up with the public, and he was a celebrity politician. I think things have changed drastically now that the light trust that he had with the backbenchers has frayed now and is really very threadbare.
Still, Flinders believes if a no-confidence vote was held into Boris Johnson's leadership this week, he would probably sail through fairly easily. But the Prime Minister has other troubles. The Omicron variant is spreading like wildfire through Britain. Johnson has so far refused to impose further restrictions. But it's a gamble, and Tim Bale, politics professor at Queen Mary University of London, says it might not pay off.
Clearly, if the government get this wrong and they underreact to the situation, and that ends up after Christmas overwhelming the NHS and lots of people dying, then I'm not sure the government would ever be forgiven for that.
Some political analysts, though, think Omicron could also work in Johnson's favour. After all, it's a good distraction from other problems, like Brexit, for example. And as for a leadership challenge, political scientist Matthew Flinders points out that with the pandemic, the job of Prime Minister doesn't look all that appealing.
The question is whether Boris is metaphorically bleeding politically and can he stem the flow? But anybody that writes Boris Johnson off does so at their peril, because the Boris bounce is famous.
But a UK poll earlier this month found Boris Johnson's approval rating as Prime Minister has dropped to an all-time low. The next British general election isn't until 2024. So I asked politics professor Tim Bale if he thinks the Boris bounce can last until then.
$64,000 question. I have always been fairly confident that Boris Johnson would lead the party into an election in 23, 24. I'm beginning to wonder, however, whether he is in fact now past his sell-by date. And I think quite a lot of Conservative MPs are wondering the same. If he turns out to be a liability, then they will be asking themselves, what's the point of Boris Johnson?
For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
There is some good news to report today in the fight against COVID. This afternoon, the FDA approved a new pill manufactured by Pfizer. It could prevent people with COVID from getting seriously ill and requiring hospitalization. The pill had already been approved in the UK, along with another COVID pill made by the pharma company Merck. Many see these new drugs as a really big deal, but questions remain about supplies and access. We reached out to Dr. Eric Topol, director of Scripps Research Translational Institute in San Diego. I asked him why he and others think Pfizer's just-approved pill is a game-changer.
I think this is the most important thing, Marco, since the pandemic began outside of vaccines. The fact that we have a pill now, which has a lot of efficacy, that doesn't require our immune system. That is, it works well against Omicron or any variant. And that's something that we need right now, obviously, with this Omicron spread throughout the world.
So how would these new COVID pills actually be used? And like when in the course of the virus would they be taken?
Well, they're effective. Paxlovid was shown even out to 5 days from the onset of symptoms with nearly a 90% reduction of hospitalizations and deaths. It's actually two different pills taken twice a day for 5 days. And what's really remarkable is that they reduce the viral load by more than tenfold very quickly. So that would be anticipated to markedly reduce transmission or spread to other people.
So let's be clear. I mean, these pills would not be a substitute for a vaccine, right?
No, they're very different. The vaccines are to prevent COVID from happening, whereas the pills are treating it and stopping the virus in its track once an infection is diagnosed.
So Paxlovid, the Pfizer pill, it's won approval in the UK and recently in Europe. But even with that effectiveness, there are issues about supply as well as access to generic versions for lower income countries. You wrote recently, Doctor, in The Guardian about this. What are your concerns?
Well, my concern is that we have the biggest advance since vaccines, but we have a grossly inadequate supply. Only 200,000 blister packs will be available, and it'll take a year, Pfizer says, to make 80 million treatment courses. Now, this is totally insufficient compared with the needs. So we need to activate, whether it's via the Defense Production Act or whatever ways that we can get production done through more than one company, because here we have a treatment which is extraordinarily effective and safe and could be extremely useful when we're trying to get people back to work like healthcare workers, to reduce transmission, to basically get control of major outbreaks in countries throughout the world. These are pills, small molecules, easy to make, very inexpensive. But we have to let the primary manufacturer, in this case Pfizer, let go, be either ordered or cooperate with massive production so that we'll have these available to everyone who needs them. We've been talking for a long time about global vaccine equity, and now we're going to be talking about global pill equity.
So again, as you said, Doctor, this is not a preventive, not a vaccine. Paxlovid is a treatment for COVID. But how do these new treatments change the equation for vaccinations? Is there an impact?
Well, the problem with Omicron, because it works around our immune response, is that we're seeing lots of breakthrough infections. In people who are immunocompromised, for example, or older and have other coexisting medical conditions, these can be serious. We've already seen people die of Omicron, and there's certainly plenty of hospitalizations. We have about 3% of people immunocompromised, not just in the United States, but all throughout the world. These people are uncovered in terms of whether they get multiple vaccines. Of course, we're still living with Delta. We're seeing the second surge of Delta in the United States with a lot of people hospitalized right now. So here we have a remedy to help them. that's something they could have available even as a backup in their medicine cabinet. So this is really an exciting advance from every way you can think about it, except for one problem. We don't have enough of them, and we have to fix that problem.
Dr. Eric Topol is director of Scripps Research Translational Institute in San Diego, speaking with us about the new COVID pill by Pfizer. Eric, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Frida is the title of the first movie by a female Haitian filmmaker to premiere at Cannes. It's a story of a young woman in Haiti facing some tough choices in life.
Frida! Les dîmes des genoux, où est-ce qu'on monte notre avalie?
Toute la sainte journée pour faire me guider, dîmes pour.
In this scene, Frida's mother is telling her that she's found her daughter a job as a waitress, and she needs to take it. But Frida has other plans for her life and tells her mother, "You are always trying to get me to quit school." The film's director is Jessica Geneus. She joins us now from her home in Port-au-Prince. Welcome to the show, Jessica. It is wonderful to meet you.
Wonderful to meet you, too. Thank you for taking the time to talking to me.
You've been getting a lot of great attention for Frida. Cannes, as I said, also the Pan-African Film Festival, and an Oscar nod championed by Francis Ford Coppola. Let's talk about Frida, the central and title character of your movie. She's a university student in Port-au-Prince. What is her story that you are telling?
I mean, Frida is a young woman that I see all the time in Haiti. Those women that, you know, they want to believe that they can stay here. They want to believe in the future in the country, even though it seems like everything is chaotic. We tend to talk a lot about those, you know, that left the country, but we tend to forget about the 12 million that are still in the country, whether it's because they cannot travel, you know, or because they choose to stay there. And Frida is that young woman that is in the middle of this crisis, you know, in the country, in a family that is asking so much from her and trying to see how to balance, you know, how to stay true to herself, how to stay close to her value and her morality.
And that value, that morality is challenged by Frida's little sister, Esther. And kind of between the two of them, we learn about the choices and compromises many people in Haiti face. I mean, Frida seems ready to fight the system. Her younger sister, Esther, though, her mother's pushing her to find a rich man, marry him. And Esther does that. She meets a senator who somehow has a lot of money. In this scene, the family is visiting the restaurant where Esther's wedding is going to take place. And the mother, Jeanette, whispers to Frida, asking her where this senator gets all his money. And Frida replies, "From your taxes." And Frida also has a choice to make, stay in Haiti and care for her family or go with her boyfriend to Santo Domingo, where he's moved to escape the violence. Why did you focus on this kind of struggle? How fundamental are these questions to most Haitians?
Right now, it's the most fundamental question, because since 2018, it has been so hectic, you know, with demonstrations and the way the government has completely neglected the need and also all the crimes that has been done to a good part of the population and even the kidnapping and everything. So it feels like there's no future, you know. It feels like every hour you have to reanalyze your choices in this country, because it doesn't feel like you can see further than, you know, the day or the week. So this young generation, they started a fight, a movement in 2018, where they really wanted to go against corruption in the country. And they were really against this government. They were on the street, you know, demonstrating. And this government wanted to silence them, try to kill them, try to make them, to scare them. And we've lost so many people during that battle since 2018. And I wanted Frida, the film, to be a testimony of that.
In your film, there are several scenes of hundreds of people demonstrating in the streets of Port-au-Prince. There are gunshots, buildings are burning, there are tires that have been set aflame. You used actual footage, I understand. What was happening at this time?
At this time, it was before I start shooting the film, even before I start writing the film, because we had to be in the street all the time during those demonstrations to make sure that we recorded everything. Because the government was saying, you know, on social media and to journalists that, oh, there were nobody on the street, you know, nobody. It was just a small thing on social media. It was not a national thing. So we needed to document that in order for us to control the narrative about it. And a lot of times, especially at the beginning, they would send police to shoot on us. And there's a lot of students, you know, from the university that you saw in the film that would go every day in front of the police to literally fight them. And some of them were killed. So that was the situation while filming all this.
I'm speaking with Haitian filmmaker Jessica Geneus about her new movie, Frida. Jessica, can you talk a bit about your own upbringing? I mean, do you know Frida's story? Because in some ways, it's also your story.
It is totally my story. I grew up in probably the one of the poorest neighborhood in Port-au-Prince. That's how I grew up. I grew up with my mother, my aunt, my cousins. So this is my story also. And I grew up seeing those women sacrificing their whole life, you know, not always making the right choices, but they were always there and to help each other. And I wanted for this film to be like a mirror, you know. And of course, when you look at the mirror, you don't like everything that you see. To be truthful with yourself and to accept what you see will allow you, you know, to have more strength to change what you don't want to see anymore. And yes, so this is who I am also, you know, Frida. And sometimes they ask me if I like Frida more than Esther. And I said, they are both me. I could have had
Esther,
you know,
younger sister. Yeah.
The younger sister, you know, the choices that she makes to marry someone and just try to get, you know, money, the easiest way that she could think of. Because when things are so hectic and complicated and hard, sometimes you feel, you know, tired of fighting and you just want to let go and find the easiest escape. Doesn't mean that it's easy, but sometimes it feels easy, you know, when you're about to do it. And of course, any choice has consequences, whether it's the good one or what's considered the bad one, they have consequences also, you know, on your path in life. Yeah.
Well, I'm really curious, Jessica, to become what you are, an award-winning filmmaker, mm-hmm. what choices did you have to go through in life so that you're not totally defined by the dysfunction of Haitian politics?
I think I had to see myself further than what they were trying to tell me that I was. Let me say that the earthquake played a big role in that, because I think after 2010, when the earthquake happened in Haiti and killed, you know, almost 200,000 people, it was like a very violent reality of the fact that you can die at any minute. You're like, what is there to lose? You know, what would stop you from trying? You know, because you could leave at any moment, you know. And I think this really, as hard as it was as a reality, it really broke something in me in terms of things that could hold me from trying, you know. So I started to fight. I started to try. I started to make a choice about how I want to go through life. And what I decided is that I'm going to look at stuff, everything that I can, even though it's something that makes me uncomfortable. And Frida is a very difficult mirror to look at, very close to what we feel right now. This is, as Haitian, that's what we feel right now. We feel angry, powerless, not knowing what the future holds for us. So I wanted this film to be a testimony of that. We don't have to be strong all the time. Strength is also realizing where you are at. And I wanted us to make peace with what we are feeling right now. You know, this sensation of being powerless, I wanted to make peace with it and be truthful about what you can do to move forward, even if it's just 1 centimeter, you know, and this is where we are. We just have to fight to find a better way because we are still alive. So there's still room for us to improve.
Jessica Geneus' new film is called Frida. Jessica, thank you very much for your time. It was lovely to meet you.
Thank you. Thanks to you.
A scene from Frida there, one of the few moments where the characters exhale and enjoy life at a nightclub before navigating the early morning streets of Port-au-Prince back to their homes. You're with the world. In the Spanish region of Catalonia, Santa won't be making the deliveries. That falls to Tio de Nadal, a magical log. Kids feed their logs and it later poops out the gifts.
Galletas, la chocolata y mandarina.
This 8-year-old says she feeds her log cookies, chocolates, and mandarins. Sweet stuff goes in, sweet stuff comes out. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. When the Taliban came to power in Afghanistan last August, they outlawed live music. Many musicians there still fear for their lives. So it came as a surprise last night when several Afghan musicians performed for a live television broadcast celebrating the winter solstice. Panchayish, Some viewers say they were moved to tears, a rare instance of Afghans winning back some of the rights the Taliban once stripped away. Mahbuba Siraj knows that struggle well. She was recently named by Time magazine one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Mahbuba runs a shelter for women and girls in Kabul. She says with the Taliban in control, every day is a struggle for shelters like hers.
In one case, there was a relative of one of the girls that showed up and wanted to see the girl that is in the shelter. And the girl did not want to see that person at all. So then we had to keep them both calm, especially the relative, because now what they do is that they right away go and they complain to the Taliban. And Taliban, before even asking the question, sometimes they come and they start making problems.
I'm curious what kind of accusations family members might be making about your shelter.
These girls, they have come from family violence. Whoever has been making their home a hell to them has been their family members. It's because of a marriage that was done in the first place by force, somebody killing somebody in the family. So they gave the family that has lost a member, a girl, to the family. So now she goes there and poor thing is just going to go to that family and become a slave there.
Mahbuba, what has the arrival of winter meant for people in Afghanistan?
You know, like right now, it's snowing outside and the weather, the temperature is dropping. My mind, my heart, my soul, everything in me is thinking of all of these people that they are outside. How do they keep warm, for God's sakes, you know, these nights? I don't know what to do. That part, I'm really desperate. And they are desperate, too. And at the same time, you know, the brain drain. Everybody left Afghanistan. We don't have anybody to do the work. A big part of the works of the ministries, those women are not allowed to go to their ministries and work.
I mean, it's clear that Afghans desperately need assistance. But at the same time, as you know, the international community does not want to aid and abet an extremist government. What do you think needs to be done?
I know that. Well, we have to find a way to do that. You know, the government members of a government of a country might be 200 people. What about the 35 million?
Mahbuba, do you have the story of someone, a girl's story, that really kind of illustrates the struggle that you're talking about?
I mean, I know of some young girls, young women, who are absolutely brilliant. They are writers of books and books of poetry and other books. They are so well-read and they are very much in danger because of some help that they have done and, you know, maybe saved some girls from being executed or some woman from being stoned to death. And today the Taliban are back in power and they want to get after them and really make life miserable for them.
Multiple challenges on so many fronts for everyone, but I'd really like to know what all of this means for your own humanitarian work for women and girls in the year ahead. What are you seeing?
In the year ahead, I'm just going to hold on. I'm going to beg the world to help and hang in there. With my girls, with my job and the work that we are doing. And I do believe that maybe it will improve. Maybe, you know, maybe. I cannot give up that. It will kill me if I'm that pessimistic, honestly.
One picture that we are getting of Afghanistan right now is that if you are a woman or a girl and you do not accept the Taliban, you have either left the country or you're in hiding. You have not left. What is your situation, Mahbuba?
I am 73 years old. So everything in my life, I've seen it, is not ahead of me, it's behind me. And then also, I have a love for this land that I cannot explain it to you, what it really is. It's in deep down in my heart and in my soul. And I don't want to leave it. So that is also one reason why I'm here and what I'm doing, what I'm doing.
Mahbuba Siraj is a well-known Afghan women's rights activist in Kabul. She's a founder of the Afghan Women's Network and runs a shelter for women and girls. Mahbuba, it goes without saying, but you are doing important and courageous work. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This month, many people across Latin America and in Latino communities in many places, they're celebrating Las Posadas, a Catholic celebration reenacting the part of the Christmas story in which Mary and Joseph search for an inn, concluding with the Nativity. Last year, the pandemic prevented celebrations. This year, there's music and dancing and renewal, including in a small farmworking town in rural California. KVPR's Mathi Bolaños brings us a story from Fireball in the state's Central Valley.
A float decorated with images of the Virgen de Guadalupe is passing by small pastel houses and people in lawn chairs holding up their phones to capture the moment. We're in Fireball, a small farming town in California's Central Valley. About 200 people walk behind the float, chanting.
¡Que viva la Virgen! ¡Que viva la Virgen!
Evelia Garcia is leading the procession. She's 64 years old and is wearing a red dress with an embroidered image of the Virgen. Others are too, and they're all a part of a dance group from St. Joseph's Catholic Church here. Because of the pandemic, this celebration, Las Posadas, was canceled last year. COVID hit towns like Fireball hard. Farmworkers couldn't afford to stay home, and this part of California still has a high number of COVID cases. After so much loss, Father Reyna Pudota says his parishioners were excited about reviving their beloved celebration. It's all outside, and people were encouraged to wear masks.
People, you know, they have faith, and they are longing because for some time they missed this in-person coming and participation.
That's especially true for Evelia Garcia, who moved from Jalisco, Mexico, to California with her husband decades ago. He worked in the fields. She worked at a factory that makes tomato paste. And Garcia kept up her Catholic faith in the U.S. She even chose the night shift at work so that she could go to morning mass every day. Then, 2 years ago, this month, her husband died of colon cancer. Next, the pandemic hit. Garcia says it's been the loneliest time of her life.
Me enfermé de estar ahí encerrada.
She got sick of being indoors and unable to go to church. She says it felt like she was dying. Her soul was dying. That changed when a friend from church brought communion bread to her house.
Se me quitó la depresión, se me quitó todo lo que tenía. Y hasta ahorita.
She says it lifted her depression. She started feeling happier, praying and singing with the church choir again. She also started teaching Aztec dances for the Christmas posadas.
Unas me enseñó mi papá y otras yo miro en la internet. Entre yo y mi hermana buscamos los pasos y cómo es y ya que lo sabemos.
She learned some dances from her dad as a kid. She found others online. Now she and her sister have taught their friends. Las Posadas have brought a lot of families in this town together. Farm worker Maria Dolores Ramirez Martinez dances with her two young daughters. They've got feathers on their headdresses and wear ayoyotes, or anklets covered with hard shells. Ramirez is grateful to dance again with her community. So is her oldest daughter, Arcelia Fuerte.
It's like really like to bring joy to the people because of COVID and all the lives that were lost.
For the world, I'm Madi Bolaños in Fireball, California.
Christmas is going to have a very different feel this year in the place where it all began, the birthplace of Jesus. In the midst of Omicron, Israeli authorities have banned most foreigners from visiting the country and the Palestinian territory of the West Bank. Daniela Cheslow is a Jerusalem reporter for the French news agency, AFP. This week, she visited Nazareth and Bethlehem to get a sense of what things are like. So, Daniela, what did you see? What was happening?
Well, Marco, first I want to set the mood in Nazareth. These are the bells of the Greek Orthodox Church of the Annunciation, and that's where believers say Mary was told by the archangel Gabriel that she would bear a virgin birth and it would be the Son of God. That's where I met tour guide Aziz Banna. He told me, even without foreigners, the season wasn't quite as terrible as it could have been.
It's not the Christmas that we hoped for, but the atmosphere is great. So we are hoping the outside tourism will come back. But still, even without outside tourism, we are still happy. We're still celebrating.
So many Jewish Israelis are going to Nazareth. Of course, most Jewish Israelis don't celebrate Christmas. So why were they visiting sites like Nazareth and Bethlehem this year?
Well, I put that question to psychologist Roni Harari of Haifa. She and her husband had just bought their two kids Belgian waffles from a Christmas market. Here's what she said. So she's saying, we won't be going overseas too quickly during this period of corona. It's too complicated for us. So here, it's a little like feeling abroad.
So how are locals in Nazareth responding to this new wave of tourism, as you said, from inside Israel?
Well, I want to play you an Arabic version of Jingle Bells. It's called Laylat Eid, that I heard all day long Saturday. And just to remind, Nazareth is the largest city in Israel for Palestinian Arab citizens. These are the descendants of people who stayed on their land in 1948. And in recent years, the city has had a real rebirth. There's dozens of new hotels and new cafes and restaurants. Hotel owner Bassam Hakim said the domestic tourism boost has helped, but it's got its limits.
The domestic tourism comes only 2 days a week, which is the weekend. So we have 5 days left. We are unemployed.
Hakim's uncle is the caretaker of the Greek Orthodox Church of the Annunciation, and he told me that Israelis don't always feel connected to the church the way Orthodox pilgrims might, and those Orthodox pilgrims leave donations that the Israelis might not think to leave.
Well, I was wondering about that because when you were on the program in May of this year, you mentioned some of the really disturbing violence between Jewish and Arab Israelis. Did that come up at all when you went to Nazareth?
Well, Marco, back in May, amid a war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, there was a spasm of violence inside cities in Israel between the Jewish majority and the 20% Palestinian Arab minority. Mobs attacked people just because they were Arab or Jewish. It was unprecedented. In Nazareth, one of the guests at Bassam Hakim's hotel was a Jewish high-tech worker from the Tel Aviv area. Her name was Orly. She said she canceled a trip to Lyon in France, and she was savoring the flavors of Nazareth during a culinary tour. And she told me being in Nazareth now feels like a return to normalcy.
It's a fragile state, you know. Everything can break out any minute. But I think everyone, to the most extent, you know, we want normal life. That's what we're after, you know.
Daniela, you also visited Bethlehem, as I said. It's always a powerful experience for anyone who's been there. Was what you saw there any different from Nazareth?
The mood in Bethlehem, Marco, was a lot more subdued. Shops selling olive wood carvings were operating on limited hours. Tour guides had near empty schedules. The Church of the Nativity had undergone a renovation, but there were few tourists to see it. And that was a real blow in a city where more than a fifth of the people work in tourism. And I think it's important to note that Bethlehem is in the West Bank, which Israel has occupied since 1967. So any tourists who are barred from Israel are also blocked from Bethlehem. And Jewish Israelis are forbidden by law from visiting the city because it's under the control of the Palestinian Authority. The head of the Palestinian Hotel Association, Elias Arja, told me that about a quarter of Bethlehem's hotel rooms are closed because of the pandemic. But, kind of similar to Nazareth, Bethlehem is seeing tourists from inside Israel, from Palestinian Arab citizens, and thousands are expected on Christmas Eve. So he told me, even though that's just a little momentary relief, he said compared to last year when most public celebrations in Bethlehem were canceled, it will at least feel like Christmas.
Daniela Cheslow is a reporter with AFP in Jerusalem, speaking with us about her visits to the holy cities of Nazareth and Bethlehem. Daniela, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Scientists have discovered something truly amazing, a dinosaur embryo, and perfectly preserved. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
The tiny baby dinosaur is all curled up, about to hatch from his egg. He kind of looks like
Dracarys,
a baby dragon on Game of Thrones, the one who grew up to torch people that Danny doesn't like. I've also heard this dinosaur called a chicken from hell, but in this case, a cute chicken from hell, because he's a baby. Darla Zelenitsky at the University of Calgary says finding a fossil like this is incredibly rare.
The skeleton of an embryonic dinosaur is so fragile that it tends to easily break down and fall apart before it has a chance to fossilize.
Zelenitsky is part of an international team of scientists who studied the fossil.
The skeleton is actually complete from the tip of the snout to the end of the tail, and the animal is curled in a lithe pose as if it just died yesterday.
She says in her 25 years of studying these sorts of fossils, she's never seen anything like it.
When I first saw the fossil in a photo, I honestly couldn't believe my eyes. It's truly spectacular.
And to think it was hiding in plain sight. A mining company founded in southwestern China in the year 2000. At the time, they thought it could be a fossil, but they weren't sure. So they put it in storage for a decade, and there it sat, until some staff were going through the boxes, found it, and saw some bones peeking through. The embryo is about 70 million years old. It's an oviraptorid, a two-legged dinosaur with feathers, about as close as you can get to being a bird without actually being a bird. And now, thanks to this fossil, scientists know it hatched like a bird too. Or rather, the birds hatched like dinosaurs.
Birds were always thought to have very unique postures in their egg before hatching. But it seems that with this new fossil, that these postures have evolved first in their dinosaur ancestors.
So if someone asks you, what came first, the chicken or the egg? You can say, the dinosaur. For the World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
It's that time of the year again. We know you love the music you hear on the show, so here you go. I won't talk my mind, boy, anyone with any little. We're sharing another playlist from the World's Newsroom featuring some of our favorite tracks from the past year. For 2021, we've got 2 hours of tunes for you, including this recommendation from digital editor Amanda Lichtenstein. Hustle is from the Nigerian artist Tenny the Entertainer. It's from her brilliant album Wonderland. Amanda calls Hustle a tender jam for days when the stress gets to be too much. You can find a link to the whole playlist on our Twitter feed. We're at The World. We also want to include on our playlist some of the tracks that hooked you this year. Message us on social media or email us your recommendations to myworld@theworld.org. Sometimes I got in my mind, sometimes I got it behind, sometimes I would have to say no. Sometimes I got to watch out of my head, and this person will go drive me to say no. So if you see me outside and I know greet you, no bags, bye bye my head. If you're ever in a park in China, you might well see groups of older people dancing in formation to pop music. Seems like good, clean fun, but these dancing groups have become nuisances because the music they play is often really loud. Now the Chinese government is responding. From Shanghai, The World's Rebecca Canther reports.
Mornings and evenings across China, public parks and squares like this one near my home in Shanghai are hives of activity. Little kids ride their scooters, young people shoot hoops, and retirees, mostly women, flock here to dance. Sometimes the groups are huge, more than 50 people, all wearing matching tracksuits and dancing to music blaring from small portable speakers. The music can be aggressively loud. The regulars love it. Shen Mian, a 76-year-old retiree, says she used to go nearly every day. It's good exercise and a way to be social after I retired, she says. And it's free. Group dancing has deep roots in China, from traditional folk dance to collective exercise during Mao's era. In the 1990s, when workers at state-owned enterprises were forced into early retirement, they turned to dancing in parks for exercise. Tang Wei is a professor of cultural studies at South China Normal University. Tang says that at the time, group dancing in public squares was promoted by the government as an inexpensive way for China's aging population to stay healthy and build community. These days, videos showing retirees dancing go viral, like this one, featuring a 70-year-old man in a knit vest completing a complicated step routine with a look of serious concentration on his face. But Tang Wei says not everyone is a fan. There's been increasingly negative reports about dancing groups, she says. Neighboring residents complain about the loud noise from the speakers. Turf wars breaking out about the use of public squares have become reliable clickbait on social media here. This video shows a fight between a group of retiree dancers and a municipal worker who's trying to clean the pavement. Now the government is stepping in. This week, state-owned media announced a new noise pollution law. Public dance groups who are reported by their neighbors could be forced to pay up to $3,000 for violating the law. The details are scarce. There's no decibel limit or set quiet hours. Professor Tang Wei says regulating public noise is important, but she worries what the impact might be on older people who can't afford fitness classes. The law should have more information about what is acceptable public dancing practice so that retirees know what the limits are, she says. The law has yet to go into effect and hasn't been finalized. Retiree Shen Mian
believes public dancing will still go on. They just need to be careful not to play their music too late or too loud, she says. At the park, I tried to ask some dancers what they thought of the noise pollution law, but I couldn't talk to them. They didn't want to stop dancing. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
In Spain's northeast region of Catalonia, Santa Claus is not the symbol of Christmas joy. Instead, kids have a magical wooden log, an unusual portal to presents, as The World's Lucia Benavides reports.
Barcelona's oldest Christmas market is full of traditional Catalan music and the usual holiday vendors. 170 stalls on the plaza in front of the Barcelona Cathedral sell pine trees, ornaments, garlands. There's also a giant log with a smiling face drawn on one side, wearing a red cap and keeping warm under an even bigger blanket. His name is Tío de Nadal, roughly translated to Log of Christmas. And he's basically the Santa Claus of Catalunya. The Tío de Nadal, often referred to as Cagatío, is covered with a blanket and symbolically fed throughout all of December. The idea is to fill him up for Christmas Eve, when children gather around to sing a song, hit the Tío de Nadal with a stick, and once the blanket is pulled up, surprise, the Tío de Nadal has pooped presents. Today at the market, kids are hitting the Tío de Nadal just for fun. Unlike Santa, each child has their very own Tío de Nadal at home. 8-year-old Paula tells me she's taking care of him to ensure good presents are pooped.
Galletas, a vegada la chocolata y mandarina.
She feeds them cookies, chocolate, and mandarins every night.
And I don't know any Catalan families that they don't have a Tío de Nadal in their home.
Gemma Fontané sells Tíos de Nadal online. She says the tradition dates back to the 17th century, though the origins are unclear. Tíos de Nadal traditionally pooped turrons, a type of nougat popular in Spain during the holidays. These days, he poops all kinds of presents. And Fontané says she realizes how strange this all may sound to foreign ears.
But it's like when you are a kid, you think that this is like normal. And when it begins Christmas, I mean, it's the first thing that we do.
But the Tío de Nadal isn't the only scatological aspect of Catalan Christmases. There's a stall at the Barcelona market with a peculiar figurine on top. He's crouching, has his pants pulled down, and is, you guessed it, pooping. It's called a caganer, which means the pooping person, and it's placed in nativity scenes. The ones sold in this stall are designed and handmade by vendor Marc Alós himself.
Alós
says the caganer is traditionally depicted as a peasant with the same red cap that the Tío de Nadal wears. But in the last couple of decades, vendors have created celebrity versions of the figurine. He says the roots of the caganer likely began in the 18th century as a symbol of fertilization and good fortune. Children would play a game where they would hide the caganer in various nooks and crannies of the nativity scene.
Bueno, es que al final yo creo que el caganer es una figura muy realista, ¿no? Es de una.
Alós says the caganer is a realistic character. Everyone can see themselves in him. And the scatological connection to the pooping Christmas log, he adds, is purely coincidental. For The World, I'm Lucia Benavides in Barcelona.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, almost over the hump. We'll see you tomorrow.